Okay, well, first I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to come here. I've really enjoyed myself. And I also applaud the people who are still here for having the stamina to make it to almost the end, one more talk after mine. So this is work that I've done in collaboration with several other people, including Eric Brown, who's a graduate student, Phil Holmes, who's a professor at Princeton. The three of us have been primarily involved with the theoretical aspects of this work. We've also been in collaboration with Ed Clayton, Janusz Rajkowski, and Gary Afton Jones, who are experimentalists at the University of Pennsylvania. And then we've, roughly every week while I was at Princeton, before moving to Santa Barbara, we would meet with Jonathan Cohen, who's a professor of psychology at Princeton, who helped to keep us honest in the assumptions that we made and so on. And here are some references. You can get them from my website if you're interested. Okay. Now, my guess is that most of you don't know a whole lot about the locus coeruleus, so I'll give a brief introduction. It's a region of the brain, and I'll describe how neurons in the locus coeruleus, or what I'll call the LC from now on, how the neurons behave during a visual discrimination task. Then I'll go through some mathematical models for neurons, including a phase reduction. Then I'll make predictions for so-called peristimulus time histograms. This is what the experimentalists measure. I'll very quickly talk about some extension to coupled neurons and then give some conclusions and work in progress. And this workshop is called Patterns in Physics. Well, debatably, this isn't physics, it's neuroscience, and debatably, it's not pattern either, but let me just say that here, I'm not thinking of spatial patterns, I'm thinking of synchronous firing of neurons as being a pattern. But at any rate, I think it's a nice application of PDEs, which fits into the broader framework of this workshop. Okay, so what is the locus coeruleus? Well, this didn't come out terribly well. This is a brain. The locus coeruleus is this little green blob right here at the top of the brainstem. It consists of approximately 15,000 neurons for monkeys. For humans, it's about 35,000. And it turns out there's one nucleus that makes up the LC. There's one nucleus for each hemisphere of the brain. Now, you might think 15,000, 35,000 neurons, that doesn't sound like a whole lot. This surely can't be important. Well, in fact, the locus coeruleus is quite important because each neuron can make up to 250,000 synapses or connections with other neurons. And they communicate with the other neurons through the release of a neurotransmitter called norepinephrine, which has been shown to regulate various cognitive functions, including arousal, sleep-wake cycles, memory, learning, stress, and so on. Yeah, this is a lot more. In the brain, there are something like 10 to the 11th neurons and 10 to the 15th synapses. So that's like 10,000 on average per neuron. So this is quite a bit more than average. Okay. Now I want to describe the experiments that are done in the Afton Jones group. Very broadly, it's a monkey sitting in a chair watching TV, okay? And debatably, it's more interesting than what you normally see on TV. The monkey is presented with a sequence of visual stimuli, horizontal bars or vertical bars, typically. And the monkey is trained, first of all, to hold down a lever, then to fixate its eyes on a certain part of the screen. Once it's fixated long enough, they have devices to detect this, then a stimulus comes. And it's trained to release the lever if it sees, say, the horizontal bar. Okay, if it gets this correct, it gets juice. That's its reward. If it makes a mistake, either by failing to release the lever when it should have or releasing it when it shouldn't have, then there's a timeout period and he has to wait longer before he can try to get more juice. And while all this is happening, the response of the neurons in the LC are being measured. Okay, so here's the type of data that the experimentalists come up with. These are the so-called peristimulus time histograms. I want to just quickly explain how they construct these. So the monkey sees a sequence of stimuli. For each stimulus, you say, okay, let's say that stimulus happened at t equals 0. And then let's measure when the neuron's fired relative to that t equals zero. Okay, and then make a histogram of those results. So for a single trial, you might actually just get a tick here, a tick here, and a tick here, but then you run this over 100 trials or maybe even up to 1,000 trials and build up the histogram that looks something like this. I think this was on the order of 100 trials. And so in some sense, the PSTHs are measuring the average firing patterns of the neurons. Okay? Now what they found is that the monkey alternated between two different states, what they called phasic and tonic state, spent approximately 10 minutes in each state, but sort of randomly switched between. In the phasic state, the monkey performed well in the task. The neurons fired slower in the absence or before the stimulus came on the order of 2 spikes per second, and there was a larger response to stimulus. In tonic, there was poor performance, faster baseline firing, smaller response to stimulus. How do you see these in the PSTHs? Well, the slower baseline firing rate means you have fewer ticks before t equals zero when the visual stimulus comes on in the phasic state than in the tonic state. This is the same number of trials in both cases, and you can see there's more going on here. That corresponds to the quicker firing. The response is essentially measured by the peak of this PSTH, and you see that it's larger here than here. Okay. Let me just mention, you can't see it in these plots, but in the phasic state, the neurons were more synchronous. They tended to fire at the same time with respect to the tonic state. I'll come back to that very quickly at the end of the talk. Well, these are actually single neuron recordings to make up the PSTHs. To do the synchrony, they would measure two at once, typically, or they can measure up to something like 24 at once in principle. And through suitable deconvolutions and so on, they may be able to get even more. But these are single neuron recordings. Seems to be of one neuron. Each neuron individually seems to fire at a slower. Well, it's not really understood at this point why it switches from phasic to tonic. Some inputs from other regions of the brain, presumably, are providing some bias which switches it between. One can argue evolutionarily and say, well, maybe it's not so bad to have two different states like this. In this situation, the monkey's really focused in some sense, whereas in this situation, it's a little more scattered. And you may think, well, at times, it's good to sort of, you know, turn your mind off and sort of just absorb the surroundings and maybe, whoa, I see something interesting that I would have missed had I been focused on something else. Yeah, very good. Very good analogy. Okay, so what we're hoping to do is some mathematical modeling to understand, in particular, is there a relationship between this baseline firing and the peak of the PSTH? Okay, can we understand mathematically those types of relationships? So let me give just a very quick crash course in how you model neurons. Here's the biophysics. You have a lipid bilayer, which electrically acts as a capacitor. You have protein molecules, which pierce through this lipid bilayer. They act as gates. They allow ions to flow from the inside to outside or vice versa. Electrically, they're nonlinear resistors. Hodgkin and Huxley, way back in 1952, which was a good year for mathematical biology. You may remember Turing published his paper that year as well, and maybe others. They published their Hodgkin-Huxley model, which essentially associated an electrical circuit with the biophysics. The way I like to understand this is to think, well, suppose you have a probe and you inject some current into the neuron. How can that current reach the outside? Well, you can have a capacitive current. You can have, turns out, a sodium current. Here's a nonlinear resistor associated with the sodium channel, a potassium current. The leak current is essentially everything else which isn't sodium and potassium. I'm told that Hodgkin and Huxley basically took a squeegee, or this was a squid giant axon, they took a squeegee and sort of squeezed out everything inside the neuron and discovered, you know, there were a huge number of ions floating around. But for their purposes, it seemed that the sodium and potassium were the most important. You'll notice there's also batteries here. Any organism devotes a lot of energy to providing some sort of bias between the inside and outside, a concentration difference, and those are represented by batteries. So Hodgkin and Huxley, they're oriented differently, so the bias is in fact different for the sodium and potassium. I mean, if you work through carefully, you can see how this works. Now, associated with an electrical circuit, you can write down a set of ordinary differential equations. In this case, it turns out it's a set of four coupled nonlinear ordinary differential equations, fairly nasty looking equations. I'm not going to show them to you, but I'll show you what happens under certain situations. You may remember I mentioned, suppose you stick a probe in and put some current inside the neuron. This is a bias current. I've just set it to a certain value. For this value, you get that the neuron fires periodically. This is voltage as a function of time. You get a slow buildup of the voltage. Suddenly, this is called an action potential. It goes up very quickly, goes down very quickly, builds up again, and repeats periodically. And just to give you an idea, this is around 15 milliseconds for the period. Now, here's the phase space actually projected into two dimensions. Remember, it's a four-dimensional set of equations. But in two dimensions, the periodic firing state is just the bold curve going around here. I'm going to define isochrons. You may remember that these came up yesterday in Tony Roberts' talk in a different context. This is more in the original spirit of Guckenheimer and Winfrey and people like that. What it is, suppose you start with two initial conditions on the same isochron and evolve those initial conditions forward in time. If they start on the same isochron, this is a stable periodic orbit, so the initial conditions under the evolution move towards the orbit. They end up asymptotically with the same phase if you start on the same isochron. Okay? So here's another isochron. I think I have 20 isochrons going around here, equally spaced in time. So you can see that actually you go around this part quicker than you go through this part of the periodic orbit. This is essentially the action potential. The voltage goes up to a high value. And I'll associate an angle with each isochron. Theta equals zero is where the neuron is actually firing. I think so. I mean, in this, when you have singular problems such as this, the isochrons all sort of bunch up, and I think they actually spiral around quite a bit here, but they're by index theory and so on. You know there is a fixed point inside here. I didn't investigate that too much, but I just wrote a little program to numerically calculate the isochrons. You can get some wonderful pictures of isochrons, actually. So you can think of, by defining these isochrons, you can think of this as essentially defining a nonlinear polar coordinate transformation, and then you can transform your system into a very simple system, d theta dt equals omega. Okay, what could be simpler than that? Plus, if you have some sort of time-dependent current being injected into the stimulus, it comes in like this. Okay, let me tell you what this function zv of theta is. It's called a phase response curve. It captures the effect of impulsive perturbations in the voltage. And I try to illustrate that down here. The solid line, it's kind of hard to tell that it's solid and the other ones aren't. The middle peak is the unperturbed problem. Suppose you start right here, inject a small delta function of current, which gives a finite change in the initial voltage. Follow what happens. Well, the peak occurs later than it would have in the absence of that perturbation. This corresponds to d theta dv, the phase response curve being negative, because it takes longer to come back around to theta equals zero to get the next fire. Okay? If you do the exact same perturbation at this point of the cycle, then the peak occurs earlier than it would have in the absence of that perturbation, so d theta dv is positive. And you can numerically calculate these phase response curves. It looks something like this. for the Hodgkin-Huxley neurons. It turns out, remember I started with the locus coeruleus, the LC. Turns out for the LC, it's better to use Hindmarsh-Rose neurons, basically the same idea as Hodgkin-Huxley. But this has a different type of PRC. You can, in fact, calculate an analytical approximation to it. It looks like this. Notice it scales as 1 over omega. This plot here is just to try to convince you that it works pretty well. The solid curve is the fit. The other curves show results from actually simulating the Hindmarsh-Rose neurons directly. You see that it works pretty well. I've multiplied by omega here to try to collapse everything to one curve. Let me just mention the form of the phase response curve can be understood in terms of what bifurcation gives rise to the firing. So Hodgkin-Huxley, Hindmarsh-Rose have different bifurcations, and so therefore different types of phase response curves. Notice, for example, this one is always positive, whereas for Hodgkin-Huxley, it could be positive or negative. Okay, so now I remind myself to show you a few movies. Right. Yeah, you would see synchronization both for Hindmarsh-Rose and Hodgkin-Huxley. It turns out you need to specify the form of the synchronization. It can be electrotonic, synaptic, and so on. And to calculate whether or not you do get the synchronization, you have to do a convolution of that coupling function with the phase response curve. And then you look, is the slope of the resulting convolution positive at zero or not? I can say more about this at some other time. Okay, so I'm going to show you a few movies here. Okay, let me pause it really quick. What I'm showing in this movie, this is sort of the phase circle. Remember I did this nonlinear polar coordinate change. Theta equals zero corresponds to the neuron firing. At the bottom, I'm showing the stimulus. So zero turns on to some constant value and goes back down to zero. Every time I cross theta equals zero, I put a little tick mark that a spike occurs. This is the voltage as a function of time. Okay, so this is just a single neuron. I've included noise, actually, in here, just to give you an idea of what happens when you turn on the stimulus. You see that it goes more quickly around this part of the circle than this part. Okay, let me just let this run one more time. So there, it's basically going at a constant speed. If I didn't have noise, it would truly be constant. Turn it on, it goes quicker in this part than this part. That's reflected in the phase response curve. Okay, what happens if we have a large number of neurons? So basically, I'm doing the same thing as before, but I start with a random uniform distribution of neurons around the circle. Every time any neuron passes through theta equals zero, I put a tick in the histogram, turn it on. Well, you see that you get this sort of traffic jam occurring near theta equals zero, which gives rise to a very large peak. This is essentially what they do when they find the PSTH, the experimentalist. Okay, so you have a peak there. We'll watch the peak form again. Now, here I've turned off noise, and you see that after the stimulus turns off, you essentially just freeze that distribution and it rotates around. Now if I, if I do a different baseline firing frequency, this one is actually faster. The stimulus is exactly the same. Qualitatively, you get the same effect. You get some sort of traffic jam, but the peak in the PSTH is much lower, just like what the experimentalists were finding. And let me just mention here, in the absence of noise, everything is clumped together, so it's going to cross over again, so you get some ringing behavior. And I'll have a little more to say about that later on. Okay, so let me cover this back up. Getting blinded by it. Okay, so no coupling between the neurons. Yeah. Right, but they're averaging over many neurons. And so that's, In some sense, I'll have a little more to say about that in the next couple of slides here. But you can think of this as essentially the neurons have no idea what the initial, or how do I say this? The neurons don't know when the visual stimulus is going to come. So they're going to have a certain phase with equal likelihood as any other phase. Okay. So you can think of starting with a uniform distribution around the phase circle. Okay, so I need to pick it up a little bit to get through this, but how do we make predictions for the PSTHs? Well, here's the equation I wrote down before. We can go to a density formulation where rho is the probability of having a certain phase, draw a little control volume, say the rate of change of probability is equal to the flux in minus the flux out, and we get a partial differential equation. Okay? And as I just mentioned in response to the question, we're going to, the stimuli essentially come at random times. The neurons have no knowledge of what phase they should have when the stimulus comes. So we'll solve this equation with a flat initial distribution. FL of t, this is the flux at theta equals zero, probability per unit time that the neuron fires. This, in fact, if you think about it a little bit, is exactly the PSTH under suitable normalization. So let me show you some results for the step function stimulus like in the movies. You can solve the PDE that you get exactly. It's hyperbolic. You can solve it with the method of characteristics. I won't show you the formulas, but just mention because we have exact formulas, we can get quite detailed understanding of what's going on. So for example, suppose we have a stimulus that turns on and stays on. Well, this plot here, is the color indicates rho. This is theta and time. This is the PSTH down here. Starts out flat. You turn on the stimulus. It turns out that rho is periodic in time as long as you leave the stimulus on. And every time you get red forming here, you get a peak in the PSTH. Now, what happens if you turn off the stimulus? Well, you freeze the density distribution that you had when it was turned off and just allow it to propagate as a traveling wave, okay? In the PSTH, you can't see a whole lot of difference between this and leaving it on. You get successive periodic peaks. Here I just want to show, this is the same as the last slide, but a lower baseline firing rate. The peak is larger in the PSTH. Let me try to line these up. Okay, it's hard to tell here, but for the higher baseline firing rate, you get a smaller peak. Lower baseline firing rate, you get a larger peak. Yeah, in this case, we've actually normalized things by sort of dividing by the number of neurons. So we're comparing apples to apples here. I won't go through the details, but it turns out you can show that the peak of this middle plot, the PSTH minus the baseline scales, is 1 over omega. Ultimately, that comes from the scaling of the phase response curve. Now, one drawback of what I've done so far, if you look at the experimental data, you don't see the ringing type of behavior that seems to be showing up in these PSTHs in the analytical work. And we realized that, well, the brain is actually a noisy place. For some people, it's perhaps noisier than for others. But maybe it's not so realistic. We're thinking, and I guess I skipped over this, but ultimately, the neurons in the locus coeruleus are getting some sort of input after the visual stimulus comes. The stimulus comes in, is filtered through the visual system somehow. At some point, the neurons in the locus coeruleus get a message that says, hey, something just happened. And we're modeling that by this I of t. Now, in fact, there's going to be some noise associated with that. So we'll just add on a Gaussian white noise random process. You then get a stochastic differential equation. If sigma is equal to zero, sigma is the RMS noise strength. If sigma is equal to zero, we would have the original equation I had before. With sigma non-zero, you get this extra stochastic term. Going to a probabilistic formulation, you get a Fokker-Planck equation, which we can't solve analytically, but we can solve numerically. And not surprisingly, this additional term is a diffusion style term. What happens is it spreads out the density and causes the peaks to die away. Okay, so here's for one value of noise, if we increase the noise, not surprisingly, the peaks decay away quicker. Again, you can make some estimates here. We had to do stochastic averaging in order to make this estimate. But you can show the envelope that goes through the peaks of the PSTHs has this type of scaling. Okay, so now we want to match with the experimental results. And we played around a little bit and determined that noise enough wasn't alone to match the experimental data. So we went to our experimental friends and asked them, well, what else should we be incorporating in our model? And they said, well, it's not so realistic to say that the neurons in the LC are either firing at 2 hertz in the phasic mode or 3 hertz in the tonic mode. In the phasic state, you're going to have a distribution around 2 hertz. And even each individual neuron over 60 trials may drift in its frequency somewhat. Okay, so both noise and some frequency distribution is going to be important. I don't have time to go through the details too much, but let me just mention here the gray is showing a histogram for interspike intervals. This is just the timing between successive firings of the neuron. And by playing around with the noise strength and frequency distributions, we could get a good match between our model and the data. Okay, so let me just mention one more experimental fact. Let me cover up. You've now seen it so much that it's not a surprise anymore. But the experimentalists also measure cross-correlograms. This is a measure of the synchrony of the neurons. You just measure 2 different neurons simultaneously when they fire, take the differences between the times at which they fire and make a histogram. In the phasic state, you get a bump. In the tonic state, it's essentially flat. In the phasic state, that means, well, if one neuron is firing, it's more likely that the other one will be firing at about the same time. In the tonic state, it's like this. Now, in order to get this type of behavior, the neurons must be talking to each other. There must be some coupling. If we incorporate coupling into our model, we can qualitatively get the same type of cross-correlograms. Here, so the coupling strength is the same both in the tonic and the phasic state. In tonic, it's essentially flat. In phasic, it peaks more around 0. And with those coupling strengths, which happen to be fairly weak, we also capture the right response to stimulus behavior that we want, namely that the lower baseline firing rate gives rise to a larger peak in the PSTH. And the lines here are just various approximations that we made. The gray bars are from full simulations of the model. Okay, so here are my conclusions. So hopefully now you've at least heard of the locus coeruleus and you'll have some idea of what it is. And I described how neurons in the locus coeruleus behave during a visual discrimination task. We modeled the neurons in the LC as Hindmarsh-Rose neurons, reduced to a phase model in the presence of external stimulus. We're able to make predictions for the PSTHs in terms of a Fokker-Planck equation, got the right type of behavior. In order to explain the experimental results, though, we had to incorporate noise and a frequency distribution and weak coupling. Some other applications, we tuned our parameters for this visual discrimination task, but then also applied it to a different task called the Erickson task. Works well. If you're interested, I can show you more about that. And you can do a similar analysis for other types of neurons. This is in the sense of bifurcation theory. Hindmarsh-Rose neurons undergo a different type of bifurcation than Hodgkin-Huxley neurons. Turns out you can broadly classify the neurons as 4 different types based on the type of bifurcation. And so we've done that type of analysis. And let me just close by putting up one last movie, which I'll leave running and then I'll... that's not... that's my screensaver. The movie, unfortunately, isn't quite that exciting. But here what's going on is I'm considering a distribution of neurons and noise with the right values in order to match the ISI histograms and so on. And so you see in the PSTH, you do get the peak that you want, but then you don't get the ringing behavior that you don't want. So I'll leave it there, and thank you very much. Thank you.